This is Gore Vidal, and I will be speaking at this level of voice.
Okay. Do you think that Hollywood, when movies first started coming into being, do you think Hollywood set out to create the mythology of modern times?
No. They set out to make money. The movies were an invention of Eastern Europeans, mostly, many of them Jews, who had started out on the East Coast in New York, some in the glove business like Samuel Goldwyn, and some push carts like L.B. Mayer. I think he was up in Boston. And they got interested, obviously, in fellow immigrants, and the fellow immigrants didn't have much money, but they were very energetic. And the main entertainment, they couldn't afford theater, and the main entertainment was this new thing called Nickelodeon, the movies. And so they began by buying up theaters. And when I say they, it's specifically the George Washington of the motion picture business was Adolph Zukor. And he bought something like 500 theaters. Theaters, they were just small rooms or warehouses around Manhattan. And then he played any film he could get his hands on, the Days of the Silence. Well, he finally realized that he lacked, as they say nowadays, product. So he went into the movie-making business and ended up with a little studio which was called Paramount. And that was the beginning of the movies, in which they went from owning theaters to owning the studios that made the stories that they would then send back. Adolph Zukor, whom I knew slightly, he died aged 100, few years ago, and was heard to say on his 100th birthday, if I knew I was going to live so long, I would have taken better care of myself. And then he died. Zukor, like so many of the new arrivals, Jewish arrivals from Europe, was very conscious of high culture. Although he'd been in the glove business or something, he still was a cultured man. So he attempted to bring classics to the screen. I think he was the one who brought Sarah Bernhardt in the movie about Queen Elizabeth, in which she was simply dreadful, but it was a good try. And it was he, when talking pictures came, more than anybody else, said, why not get the greatest living writers? Let's get George Bernard Shaw. Let's get Molnar. Let's get W. Somerset Maugham. So there began, it was really trying to do something for the masses, help them into the American culture, which after all was an offshoot of European culture. And the movies, the silent movies, were great indoctrination. Now, was indoctrination conscious? No, of course it wasn't. Other than giving them culture and see what happens. So he made, I remember I was on a program on television with Lillian. I remember I was on television once with Lillian Gish. And she said the greatest disaster to befall the movies was talking pictures. I said, come on. Talking pictures are finally, you know, the apex of the movies. She said, yes, but with talking pictures, we lost the world. We had a whole art in silent film which reached everybody. Any Chinese peasant could understand us. Any French intellectual could understand us and get much the same response. We had everybody. Once you get languages, you run into people don't know the language if it's spoken. If it's dubbed, dubbing was generally so terrible then. Subtitles, who can read? So it was all fragmented. And she said, with that, the movies lost their extraordinary power to make one world, culturally, theoretically. Beyond that, the attempts made to, how shall we say, instruct as well as amuse were never terribly strong, aside from the first wave of movie makers and a slight desire for high-toned plays, which were generally rather bad ones. It was simply to make money with an audience that always went to the movies. It was an automatic one. However, in contrast to the people who make movies now and for the last 50 years, I was under contract. I was the last contract writer at MGM from about 1954 to 57. And movies by then, of course, they had been bent by television. They were desperate. They were trying to find new audiences. One thing they hated to a man was history, except big epics like Ben-Hur. We have never had a good movie about George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Aaron Burr. I know I've written the books that should have been made into films. Never, even though I myself wrote films and could very easily have produced one or directed one. The hatred was so great of American history, unlike the first generation, Mr. Zukor, who actually did a Valley Forge, a George Washington film, one of the few ever made, the American past was never tapped. That is an omission well worth a few hundred PhD theses. It's an interesting omission. And it could well be that we don't want our past remembered. The only great attempt was the really famous one, Birth of a Nation, in which we get a really racist film, but it was an attempt to look at the American past, and there was so much objection to it, I think it scared people off.
Do you feel that, I feel that mythology, storytelling, the art of storytelling has been replaced this century by cinema. This is what people wanted. In fact, perhaps even reading has been replaced by the visual image on the big screen. Is that something that you would agree with? I mean, how do you see the films, especially of Hollywood, which, if anything, have been the films that have colonized the world?
Well, we're certainly, there is no doubt that we're in a post-literary period. The reading skills, as they call it, of American people and Europeans as well, diminish with each decade, and audiovisual increases its audience. There used to be books for children. Did you know that? Most people don't. Books written for children to read, and children love to read them. And very often, they would then go on to read grown-up books and perhaps literature. These books are very seldom written anymore because it has been discovered that the average child today wants to play video games, particularly in America. They are experts at the video techniques. They can't read with any great ease, so yes, indeed, your point is well taken, that the movies have replaced literature as a pastime, as an entertainment, even as high culture.
Have they given us the heroes that we've lost in times when mythology filled that place?
Well, mythology goes on, whether it is going to be Charlie's Angels or Dusa in a play by Shakespeare. It goes on. Mythology is a general word for, as Jung would have put it, I suppose, if he ever put it, the archetypes of the human race, and certain stories recur and recur and recur, and we will get them no matter what form the storytelling takes.
What, can you give me some examples of these recurring archetypes?
Well, I mean, we prefer acting them out in public. The harvest god who is shot down in Dallas so that the harvest will be good. That is the Jesus Christ story. That is the John F. Kennedy story. That is a recurring mythical, not only story, but rite in many of the classic religions. We have the story of Osiris and Isis, even further back into ancient Egypt. These stories, the search for. We have Odysseus, the search for, first of all, through cunning and through superior intelligence, he gets to know other people after he has helped destroy Troy. And on his voyage home, It's a voyage of awakening, of finding out. Voyages of awakening and finding out are a common theme in the movies. So don't worry about mythology being lost. What has been lost is the superiority of literature to film. That superiority is permanent. However, the ability to read and write eventually will have atrophied because of the triumph of the audiovisual. Now, why is literature so superior? It is because it is one mind at work with a piece of paper or whatever he or she is writing on. It's one mind working, speaking directly to one reader. And there is a kinetic energy which is known as intellect that must be engaged no matter how low the level of the literature involved. It is a real lightning flash between reader and writer, which does not exist between the passive viewer and the action on the screen. The viewer sits there doing nothing. It's all done to him. I have often made the point that the movies are the only art form, first, that do not really have an artist, despite the attempts of the French to turn the directors into that, or the only art form that cannot dramatize an idea. They can dramatize an emotion. They're very good at that. But an idea? And when they attempt it, my God, how they fail. Battleship Potemkin. Everyone, every cineast admires the scene of the baby and the buggy going down the steps, bump, bump, bump. Well, it's a very arresting scene. What does it mean? It does not engage the mind. It engages the eye and the emotions. So you have an incomplete art form. And the fact it's a collective one means that there's no single intelligence holding it together as there is in a novel or a poem.
Then why would you say that people all around the world have taken so quickly, so deeply to film? Is it something in us that needs the myths that cinema provides?
It's there. That's why these things are done. They take to it because there isn't anything else. The makers of terrible American television say, well, look at the ratings. It's what the people want. The people never know what they want until they're given something good. They are used to what they get, so therefore they look at what they get. That doesn't mean they particularly like it, and that doesn't mean it's particularly good for them, or that it is anywhere near as good as it ought to be. When you say people, you know, as though they said, oh, let's throw all the books out and go to the movies. Well, you do that if you haven't been taught how to read in school. The teachers don't know how to read either.
But why does it have to be either or? You're a terrific reader, and I know you're a great film watcher. You said that you used to see 5 films a day at a time when it was very difficult to manage to see 5 films a day. Why can't you be both?
Well, some people are both. But I'm saying it is now coming to an end, the bothness that I was referring to. I was born in the year that talkies really came in. So my life has really spanned practically the whole history of cinema. I'm quite aware of the developments that happened in my lifetime. How, in a sense, the movie of Gone with the Wind in 1939, when I was 14 years old, the same year as The Wizard of Oz, how these shoved to one side the books from which they came. Don't act as if this were somehow a great populist movement to replace elite books with a popular and vulgar art. It was no such thing. It was a form of commercialism which preyed upon, because it had to have some source, plays, novels, whatever source they could find. These were easy to watch and do not engage the brain. Now, here's the physiological response to television. You are not supposed to stare into a light. It is very bad for your optic nerve. More important, if you look, and that's what television is, you're looking into a light. When you look into a light, the alpha waves of your brain, which is when you're properly thinking and paying attention, very quickly drop to beta waves, which is when you're wool gathering. It's like staring into the fireplace, and you start to muse, and you're not all there. Many times I've found watching the news on television that I really haven't followed it. They've suddenly gone from Turkey to Egypt, and I haven't noticed that they moved. And then I finally have to wake up. It's slightly narcotic. It's the wrong technology. Now, if you cast the picture from the TV set onto the wall, making it more like movies, you don't suffer that alpha to beta waves or lessening of attention and lessening of intelligence.
Do you feel that... Do you think that the role of myth is to underline or explain perhaps what's happening in our own lives?
Well, myth is myth. I mean, there are certain basic ones which are due to our physiognomy and our story of evolution and our story of human societies, of family. They're just about, there are only so many stories to be told. And they recur. So what difference does it make whether you see it in a movie or you see it in literature? The only thing is literature does it better and is better for the brain, exercises the brain. I give you the picture of one mind is creating on a page something which is electric, which is then being received by the eye of the reader, and that's electric. Something is happening when Montaigne writes and one reads him. That's what he saw literature as, a long conversation between individual writers and individual readers. If the millions want to go and stare at the movies and see Star Wars for the exciting technical effects, well, why not? There's nothing wrong with it. But basically, it is outside culture. It is just amusement.
Do you think there have been some movies that are called groundbreaking movies that have broken taboo subjects that have brought taboo subjects out into the open? Do you feel that Hollywood actually does smash taboos, or it's always way behind what the actual society is already doing? You know, like perhaps Guess Who's Coming for Dinner about a black man, you know, wanting to marry a white girl. Was that it was something new in a movie, but was that something new in society? Or did it legitimize it when Sidney Poitier becomes the black man, you know?
Well, you're talking about Hollywood now, and it doesn't really mean movies. There are other countries that are making other movies, not to mention India's numerous thousands of films with a whole different set of myths. You actually get to see Vishnu and a musical comedy as well. Hollywood is always 20 to 30 years behind what is going on in the society. It has to be, because the movies are terribly expensive to make. They have to raise a lot of money. I speak now of the old studios. It's even worse now, because the money is much bigger. So they have to be very careful not to offend anyone. Now, political correctness is on the scene, so you really can't make a joke about anybody for fear that you're being racist or sexist or ageist. So the movies is not the place to be daring. This is why they're intellectually so boring. And they have been for most of my life, and I'm a great movie buff, and I've seen many thousands of pictures. And I've written about 20 films that were made, and heaven knows how many television plays I did. So I have been very much part of the process as well as part of the audience. And I have done my best to raise, just as far as subjects goes, the degree of understanding, let's say, of American politics in The Best Man, a film that seems to be now rather forgotten. And it was, for 30 years, it was very much alive. Every American election, now they're redoing it. So it'll be back in some form. But to show how American politics really works, that was something useful that I was able to do in the theater first in 1960. Then it became a film with Henry Fonda in 1964. And won me the Critics' Prize at Cannes, and this was supposed to be something new, a realistic look at American politics which was totally unlike the really maudlin films of Frank Capra, which was until then the Hollywood norm for dealing with American politics. And I had done something very sharp, satiric, and realistic that had not been attempted before. Lately, they've been attempting it with mixed results.
Bob Roberts. Did you like that film, Bob Roberts, where you also played a very good acting role?
Yes, I liked it. It was sort of a child of The Best Man, in a way. And but it cost very little to make, and of course made no money at all. They are rather cursed, because those who make the major films and those who write about them in the major media, or flack for them, really want stupid pictures. I mean, they think that's what the public wants. The public doesn't want probably blank verse or Shakespeare because it's too difficult, but when you do give them, I don't much admire the works of Zeffirelli, but when he gave them a teenage Romeo and Juliet, the audience loved it, even though the language was difficult for them. English language was difficult for Anglophone audiences. This year is a great year for Shakespeare because of Tom Stoppard's movie. And you can catch them every now and then, but the people who make the films want to make a lot of money. And nothing that depends upon character, wit, dialogue is really going to be made. In a way, they seem to be going back to silent films where everything is visual. And most movies, you find there are a lot of good small movies being made now out of Hollywood. But in general, I've acted in a few movies lately, and the actor's job really is to provide a caption for the picture that the audience is seeing. Oh, look over there, that old gasworks would make a wonderful cover for our counterfeit ring, you say. And that's to tell the audience, oh, that big building over there is going to be used for a counterfeit ring. And that's about all the actor has to do. Then there's a lot of I hate you, bang, bang, I love you, into bed, and simple, simple plots.
Do you feel that movies reflect the difficulties in being a male today? You talked about the rise of PC when it's kind of not okay for, you know, men to be the big, strong John Wayne character that they used to be. Do you think that this modern idea of politically correct has kind of changed the whole ball game as far as the heroic ideal goes? I mean, what do you think of the modern heroes?
Well, there's certain constants. Males are always going to be physically stronger in general than females. At this moment, a politically correct woman will point to a heavily bearded woman from the Ukraine who is a shot putter and say, look at Dora Wildenstein, you know, she is so strong. But by and large, that the imbalance physically between them and the fact that they have different sexual roles is far more important than whether you cast a woman as a serial killer, you know, which is actually kind of fun in a kinky way. And I think that's a useful opening up of movies. I think women should... I always wrote women in my plays and movies exactly as I wrote the men. They never said things that women are supposed to say in cliché movies. Oh, champagne. Oh, the bubbles always tickle my nose. I never did any of that. Most of the writers out there just automatically, they have woman dialogue, which is very sappy, and man dialogue, which is loud and emphatic and dull. If you work with the two sexes as though they each had a brain, though if you're going deep into character, the character of a man, the character of a woman, starts to part at a certain moment. He is meant to inseminate as many women as he can get his hands on, and she has to take 9 months to lay an egg. She's on one track, and he's on another track, and the idea of monogamy has never worked very well. But we're a very slow race, and we haven't figured that out yet. So every now and then I bring this news to my readers and viewers.
Do you think that the movies provide us with good heroic roles right now?
Well, that's not their function. I mean, I suppose Ufa under Hitler wanted blonde Aryan gods to obey their Führer. We have a dictatorship too, but it's the dictatorship of money. It's the dictatorship of give the consumer what we think he wants according to the last polls we did. Anyway. What a ruling class wants in any country, and particularly in a commercial civilization like the United States, they want two things from the people. They don't want heroes, and they don't want heroines, and they don't want people who think. What they want are docile workers who will do jobs they don't like for long hours, for little pay, and they want enthusiastic consumers. That's why advertising is the only art form that has been produced by television. The ads are wonderful. It's just what's in between them that isn't so good most of the time. Now, if the aim of your society is to create docile workers and enthusiastic consumers, what is the point of showing a knight going after the grail? What is the point of depicting anyone autonomous? Most of our literature in English, and certainly I would say most of films, you have the hero who is meant to make the man feel better, or the heroine who is meant to make the woman in the audience feel better. But every story except the fairy tales, like Spielberg, every story is about victims and how to make, either if it's a sad story, they really are sad. These are about victims, made by victims, for victims to watch, for victims to feel better about the fact that they have no control over their lives and they never will have any. But perhaps sitting in a movie house, they will be sufficiently distracted that they can have fantasies of being free and powerful, which is what they do. And that has always been one of the great appeals of literature. It's why it has existed for so long. And now it has an upstart rival, which will be taking its place quite soon.
I was particularly impressed by a point you'd made in your book, Screening History, where you said that things are not reality is not real to us, really, until we see it on screen. And then it sort of underlines and creates a reality out of that we don't get from our reality in our imaginations. I mean, can you sort of tell me how you came to that point? Discuss it a little bit.
Well, I'm just saying what art is. Why bother with art when you've got life? I mean, why read about somebody else's marriage when you've got your own marriage to fret about or other people's to look at? Art adds, as Henry James said, interest. It adds resonance. It adds space around an object so that you can see it and understand it. Then you identify with it in some way. And you have been illuminated. That was always the function of poetry, literature, theater, and it is a function in its collective way of moving pictures. They can do it, but they don't do it so well. However, it is now their game.
I'm surprised how, in a way, down you are about films. You know a lot about movies, you watch a lot, you call yourself a movie buff, and you've seen an awful lot of films. You've participated in the making of them, yet you don't seem like any kind of fan at all because you've got quite a lot of negative things to say about cinema.
First, I'm a critic. You don't come, there are not many of those around. Secondly, I know a great deal about literature. You don't find anyone now who does that outside of an institution. So I'm not in any category that you've encountered. I'm a literary man who has had a great deal to do with film and quite enjoyed it. And I've done my best at various times to try and do something with it, to make it happen in a more interesting way. It's never going to go as deep as Homer's Odyssey, let us say, or as a George Eliot novel. You know, she plumbs great depths. I've never seen a movie do that. It's a popular form that, if it were in the right hands, but it's always been the hands of big money, in the proper hands, I think you could probably develop it. Woody Allen is about the best we've got, and he has created his own world, with some of it's marvelous, some of it isn't, but at least he has made his own vision of life. Now, he's what I would call an auteur in the ridiculous French sense. After all, he writes them, he plays in them, directs and produces. That's a proper use of film. And if you could keep the prices down, the costs down, you might get more of that individual statement. And but my God, who has the endurance of Woody Allen? I mean, how he does it, I don't know. In fact, he's beginning to fade a bit because he's let go his acting company and is trying to be more commercial. In other words, he's trying to live in a world in which money dominates his art form. The nice thing about literature is all you need is a pencil and a piece of paper.
How do you account for the tremendous popularity of film stars? In India, they're basically worshipped as gods because they play gods. Hollywood can pay tens of millions of dollars for a particular individual to star in a film. Fan magazines have always been big sellers. I mean, why do people worship film stars in the way that, you know, it's almost as if they are on some kind of special Mount Olympus. They are little gods and goddesses that we look up to.
Well, when literature was king, they felt the same way about Little Nell in Charles Dickens. People got this out of literature. They read books. You never lived in a period or a country where reading was of any account. It was always a minor thing for your generation. It was pretty much the same for my generation, but there was still a certain intensity about novels, about characters in them, and people saw... They illuminated the prospect. You're now talking about something for illiterate people or badly educated people or not educated, very simple people whose lives are pretty unhappy. And now they can go and fantasize they're up there on the screen. Of course, then they think the people up there on the screen are 100 times life size. And therefore, whoever it is whose image that they see projected on the screen, they identify with some sort of godhood. More or less literally, I gather, in India, and symbolically, at least in countries like the United States. On the other hand, there has never been a period in which movie stars are so quickly torn up and thrown away. In the United States, two failures, and you vanished. An actor like Clark Gable in the 30s, 40s would make 5 pictures a year. I think Betty Davis once made 8 pictures a year at Warner Brothers, of which 4 are classics. And now you don't get to make 8 pictures in 10 years unless you really have struck, let us say, a pose that plays very well with the general public. Clint Eastwood went on and on and on for many years, not going on and on anymore. I launched 2 actors through 2 TV movies. I found it much easier to get something done my way on as a television movie than I would as on the screen. I launched Alec Baldwin in Dress Gray, A Murder at West Point, and Val Kilmer in Billy the Kid. Marvelous actors, very attractive, what the world wants. They went on to do big movies. And they're both declining, and it's been less than 10 years since I had them in my movies. So from their start in these 2 TV movies, which were seen by, I don't know, in America by 30 million people, then they go on to Hunt for Red October and whatever it is that Val did, that the comic strip movie.
Batman.
Or like Val Kilmer and Batman, and some very marvelous stuff he did, with particularly that film with from the H.G. Wells story with Marlon Brando. And he's all over now. Well, in the old days, the studios kept you going for 30 years. If you had any audience, they would look for properties for you to be in. What happens now is that an actor becomes popular. He can get $10 or $20 million, but just once. And if he doesn't make it back, he's going to have trouble finding another picture. And it'll be a much smaller price, and so on. So these are not the gods and goddesses that they were in the great days of MGM, where you just went on, and the public watched you get old on screen. The last great star was was Paul Newman. And his first picture, I think, was mine, The Left-Handed Gun. In fact, Val Kilmer did a version of it. My Billy the Kid was based on what I had done with The Left-Handed Gun originally with Newman, and that was, my God, 45 years ago. Well, he's in his 70s now. He's still playing a leading man, you know.
Sean Connery, too?
Sean Connery, less so. He's having more trouble than Newman is. I mean, let's say over 70, you're not exactly going to be a screen lover, no matter how well you act or how well preserved you are. But they had what we would have called normal careers in the old days. Gable worked till he died, Bogart till he died. It never occurred to anybody not to have them on the screen. Here, the second there's any trouble, we don't want him. And that's that.
Is that because everything? But people say that's because the movies are run by money now. But weren't they always run by money? I mean, you started off saying they were started off just to make money by businessmen.
Yes. Well, they've always been about money and to make money. But it's a difference between, let us say, Japanese fishing. They send out these boats that kill everything in sight, so there are no more fish left to breed. That's what they do nowadays with the movies. They just take up too much, too many fish. With the studio, it was like an aquarium or like a fish farm. They realized, well, you don't get as much as you would if you went out and killed every fish in the Bering Sea. So you have your own lake to keep the image going, which you put trout in, and you let them grow up, and then you take them out as you need them. That's the difference between a conservative, conservationist approach to filmmaking and the all or nothing. Grab it all, because there may not be anything left.
It's strange that you use that analogy, because, I mean, just reading what little I have about Hollywood in those days, I would never have thought that they were conservationist. I mean, they were famous for chewing people up and spitting them out and destroying lives, and all the great stars who turned to booze and drink and drugs and heaven knows what.
That was not the studio's fault. That was the fault of perhaps of an indulgent way of life. More to the point, it was in 1919 we put in something called the Prohibition of Alcohol. This made the United States, until 1933, a country of alcoholics. The early days of movies were very hard drinking, and a lot of them became alcoholics, as did a lot of plumbers and realtors and lawyers. It was a country of alcoholics due to trying to regulate the morals of the people, which government has no business doing. I would say that caused most of the trouble. As for the studios themselves, yes, we hear dramatic stories from actors who failed. And occasionally, I was just reading an interview with Louise Reiner, whom I used to know quite well, and how L.B. Mayer destroyed her career. She destroyed it. She was so disagreeable and so limited and so arrogant that finally nobody could stand her, and L.B. Mayer fired her. And she said in this interview recently, she's just turned 90, he said he would destroy me, and he did. Oh, I've known her all these years. She really had a gift for self-destruction. L.B. Mayer is, after all, the head of only one studio, and there's plenty of other places to work. Hollywood was not that well organized. I suppose if you offended one of the moguls, there are only about six of them, so they might have blackballed you. This was more apt to happen to a writer or a director whose views they didn't like than to an actor who's, after all, is a commodity. And you don't destroy your commodity if you can still sell them. Those contracts, they were paid so little. I used to know Garbo, and she was telling me how little she actually got for a movie, and she'd make five, six, seven a year. And she hated these revivals, because she was a very practical, rather not very imaginative woman. And she said, "Oh, yes, it's marvelous. And I think I get no money when you see Ninotchka again. I don't want to see it. All I think they get the money. I don't." Well, that's the price of being a contract player. And that's how it was done. I'd sign these people up for 7-year contracts and then lend them out for, while paying them $30,000 a year, they would lend them out for $10 million and keep the difference. Well, that's business.
I read a quote from someone, I can't remember who said, "It's when you think about it, the great work was done by the Hollywood stars when they were all imprisoned, and one would have thought that they'd do even better work when they were free, but actually they never did. The minute the doors opened of that prison, of the studio system, that the quality of work was never repeated."
Well, in general, I think that was probably true. The stars, by and large, were not terribly well educated. And they often had ideas that were opposite to what the studio saw them as. The studio, after all, the studio is apt to, wants to sell the stars, so they'll put them in something they want to do. So if you have a man who's very good as a cowboy with a gun, and he wants to play Lord Byron, they carefully keep him from Lord Byron. So when he gets free, then he immediately does Lord Byron. And he knows nothing about writing, he knows nothing about directing, and he gets a mess on his hands. That was when, during the 50s, the stars were all free. I mean, the studios collapsed. So the stars at first took over. They made so many mistakes. The directors had now, in the 50s, were elevated by Bazin and the people at Cahiers du Cinéma into great auteurs, so they became more important. But suddenly somebody had to do something about the stars so they wouldn't make any more bad choices, so the agents took over. So today it's creative artists that is really like MGM in the 30s and 40s. And they tell their stars, "Look, you work with this director and we'll get you that writer and the script and we'll put it together and we'll make a package." They're not brilliant at it, but I think they're better than, let's say, somebody like poor Val Kilmer left on his own, who's actually quite an intelligent guy, but he needs help.
Tommy, can you tell me what you think are the enduring symbols of myth, and can you tell me what your favorite archetype or myth and or film is?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, archetype or myth? I mean, well, everything's got an archetype in it, even the worst film. But if it isn't properly delivered, you might miss it. I would say that well, it depends on what level we're talking about. The Earrings of Madame d'Urve, Offals, I think is an extraordinary movie with Daniel Darrieux and Charles Boyer in his native French, where he's a marvelous actor. And it's a very elegant and sad story by Louise de Villemorin. And that is about as effective as you can get. I don't know how mythical it is. Is it just the wife who cheats on her husband and the husband cheats on the wife, and they lead a very civilized 1880s life in Paris? Only there is a magic plot about these earrings that keep being lost and found. Then, still in the French scene, you have Les Enfants du Paradis, the second part. I don't much care for the first part, but each is a separate movie, and the second part is as great a romantic picture of possession and loss, with Barrault and Arletty. Then to go over to the English side, Carol Reed's... odd man out is this nearly perfect picture. And it is a man on the run, an Irishman, IRA, presumably. James Mason, who was probably the greatest screen actor of talking pictures that ever lived. Most unsung because he was so good, nobody noticed it, but from Lolita to Odd Man Out, there was nobody like him. And you watch him dying, and there's a great scene between him and Robert Newton, who plays a drunken poet, painter, who wants to paint his portrait, and the man's bleeding to death, and they can't take him to hospital because he's wanted by the police. So Mason sits in the studio being painted, and Mason is going in and out of consciousness, and he said, suddenly he realized, he said, "Look, I'm dying." Newton says, "We're all dying, but you're doing it. Oh, I'm getting it now." And Outcast to the Islands, Carol Reed with Trevor Roper, another great unsung actor, and Ralph Richardson. And this is a young man, must be the 18th century, Captain Ralph Richardson has befriended this man who's a wastrel. And at the end of it, he leaves Trevor Roper. At the very end, just one of the great endings of any movie ever made, he abandons him on a desert island, and the captain, Richardson, gets into the dinghy that's going to take him back to the ship and leave the guy there forever. And Trevor Howard says, "You can't leave me here like this. This is terrible. Why are you doing this to me?" And Richardson said, "Because you are my mistake." Well, that tells you a lot mythically, doesn't it?
Tell me, let's do this as the last question of the film series. Do you think that there are any great bogeymen left in movies today? In the old days, it was the mythological monsters or the god who was really cheesed off at someone and took his revenge. But do you think, since the sort of days of Dracula Vampire, do you think there are, what is the last bogeyman of cinema, do you think? Or what are the modern bogeymen, if there's more than one?
The weekend opening box office is the biggest. That determines the fate of the film. If you don't open big on the weekend, the star's out of business, the movie's out of business.
I was actually talking of the...
I know you were, and I've changed the subject to something more interesting. I can't think of a monster. Let's ask Spielberg to make one for you.
Do you think Spielberg does get the bogeyman right? Does he appeal to our love of terror? You know, Jaws and the Raptors in his Jurassic Park films. Do you think he gets the bogeyman in the shape of these monsters?
Well, he doesn't for me, but he doesn't make the films for me, does he? No, I find him extremely dull. And I'm not interested in loud noises. And I like dialogue. And, of course, he doesn't have any that's worth listening to. No, I think the greatest horror movie was the first Mummy. With Boris Karloff. And that is terrifying. It's still terrifying when you watch it. The mummy in his case, and you see in the wrappings the hand move. It's one of the great horror moments in the history of film.
Why?
Because it looks so real. It looks like a real mummy has come back to life after 2,000 years. That is horrifying. I suppose mythologically we can put it down to Persephone returning from the underworld with Pluto. They are basic things. The dead coming to life has always been alarming to the human race. It continues to be well done. I gather the new mummy is not so good. Good young actor, though, Brendan Fraser. We were in a film together called With Honors. And he's got so good since then. He was quite good in that, but he's turned into a marvelous comic actor on the Cary Grant matter. You haven't read Myra Breckinridge, but if you had...
I have.
Well, then, if you have, don't remember it.
I do.
Then you should have mentioned, and not forced me to mention, apropos this, how I said at any given moment, the gods of the movies are so few. There is the blonde goddess. There is the dark seductress. There is the freckled white boy. There is the godlike dark Indian or whatever. But there are just so many. There's a Betty Davis. There's a Spencer Tracy. There's Hepburn. There are about 12 archetypes. And I name them, and I categorize them, and I've totally forgotten how I did it. But that passage alone, if you look it up, will show you how the types are limited. And suddenly, with Monroe's death, there was need. There was a hole up there for the zoftic, blonde, voluptuous star woman. So immediately, a lot of blondes were being auditioned and cast. So there is always a need for these. You have to replace them because they don't live forever, or they don't stay young forever. So this Mount Olympus is constant and has proved to go on and on. Every single star today can be matched with a similar one 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, back to the beginning of the movies and probably in the theater even longer.
So, but you had also said, Myra Breckinridge, that there is one and there's only one. So there's only that space for them. But
at the top.
But there's Kim Basinger, there's Michelle Pfeiffer. I mean, there's several of these blonde voluptuaries in modern cinema, for example, that are trying to fill that seductress femme fatale role.
Your phrase "trying to fulfill" is well chosen. Yes, they are trying. Has it occurred to you that they don't, because they are made up, they're not the real thing? Authenticity is about the only thing audiences pick up on, and it's why the movies are essentially, this goes against all popular wisdom, all cineast wisdom, the movies are essentially a star medium. Louise Brooks got this years ago, and she said when the directors became all important thanks to the French, she said, the directors were always so jealous of the stars because we had the public. Everybody knew us. Nobody knew them. Nobody wanted to know about them. And she said, the war between the stars and the directors was won by the directors in the 50s, when the auteur du cinéma. Was won during the 1950s, when the Cahiers du cinéma selected the directors as the prime creators of movies. In the long run, I find if I go to get a film, I've got quite a large collection, I go mostly for the actor. I want to see Alec Guinness. I'll see Betty Davis in anything. I'll see Garbo in anything. There's some very famous male actors I can't see in anything. They don't interest, they bore me. Occasionally there's a movie that, for the sheer writing or the wit of it or something, that you want to see it. But it is still a star medium. So now, to get back to your theme of mythology, yes, there's so many gods on Olympus. Yes, there are a lot of people trying to fill that space. But there's only one Diana, the chaste huntress of the night, the goddess of the moon. There's only one moon goddess. And when she comes, everybody knows she's there, even though there may be 30 people in competition for it. And even though studios will be cynically trying to create one, as they did when they got tired of, forget who it was, and invented Kim Novak. Well, she was everything she ought to be. She was handsome, she was blonde, she was this, she was that, and she wasn't a star. Monroe was.
Is there one today who could fill their place?
Well, I don't pay that much attention now to the box office. Who, is there a great leading actress in the world? No. But there are also no studios. I mean, you have to have Mount Olympus before you can have the stars on them. Well, the studios were, each one was a kind of Olympus. And Hollywood taken together was the ultimate Olympus. They come and go too fast now. Result, the public isn't interested in movies.
They like blockbusters. That's a sign they don't like stars. They don't like characters. They want dinosaurs. They want exploding machines. Well, you start to want that when you no longer have archetypes. You no longer have myths, and you don't have anything that you want to fantasize about or identify with. So it may well be we've come to a new thought here, that with the killing off of the stars, the actors, despite the amount of money they still can get, some of them, they aren't fulfilling their mythic roles because they're being used up too quickly. It takes time to create a Betty Davis or a Clark Gable. I mean, it took studios 10, 20, 30 years to build them up and build them up. And once they were up there, you couldn't get rid of them. I mean, they would die on the screen, finally. That's gone, and that's why I really tend to go back when I watch movies for interest, in spite of some very good new movie makers. I love the Coen brothers, and I'll see anything Woody Allen makes. But I would rather watch Betty Davis in The Letter. I've seen it 30 times. It is one of the perfect movies, and they're not. I mean, there's not a wrong step in it. And it's all done with her eyes. And Wyler, whom I worked with on Ben-Hur, I don't usually give much credit to directors, but he got the best out of any script that he had. That's why he has no style. Everything is what was written. He doesn't impose himself. He just brings out what is good in it. And give him anything half good, and he'll make it look very good. And he once said to me about actors, he said, you know, he said, I'm supposed to be a great director for actors. And he said, but I'm not. He said, I can't make an actor look good, but I can keep a good actor from looking bad. He said, that's the minimum.